right, let's get started. I reprinted one of the handout that I gave you last time because I made so many changes in it that it's easier. So you'll just have to use the new one today, and if you made notes on the old one, you'll have to transfer those later. It's frustrating for students when I make so many changes in editorial. So let's just go through this second goal today, the goal of localization of function. And remember the reason for it. It was such a complex task to try to follow reflex pathways from stimulus side to the response side. Even in the spinal cord, it's very difficult. And in the forebrain, it's exceedingly difficult. So the idea is to localize functions, specify functions of specific brain areas without worrying about circuitry within them, or sometimes many people have pursued that goal without even coming up with a connectionist model in the manner of Wernicke. And we talked about how the early ideas of localization based on the idea that the soul is not something material. So they located it. And yet they knew the brain was important for conscious human function, so they localized them in the ventricles. I've added Spurzheim here because even though Gall was the originator of phrenology back in 1790, it was Spurzheim who in the United States made it so popular. In his writings, he was the popularizer of phrenology. And these assumptions of phrenology are interesting because the first two we pretty much agree with now, even though certainly in America we believe that experience shapes behavior too, that experience is shaping a brain that you're born with. And brains are a little different from family to family and from person to person. There's evidence for that, not mostly in the Russian studies where they've looked at different families, some major brain structures that were found to vary among families. And certainly when brains have been studied in any detail, they notice many differences from brain to brain. We call that kind of study where you look at slices of brain and look at cells seen in a cell stain, we call that cytoarchitecture. Okay, the cytoarchitectural characteristics of brains differ a bit from person to person. Then they believe that that differences in character and ability imply differences in structure, and that this was manifest as different in size. Now, there's evidence for that when we look at compare different species. Very visual animals have large visual structures. Structures of the visual system are larger in those animals. Animals that have fine tactile ability, like ourselves, particularly sensitive in the fingertips, those areas representing the fingertips are enlarged in our brain. So we have that kind of evidence. But when it comes down to many details, the evidence is not so certain. Because not only size matters, what else besides size would make a difference? From what you know now, what would you guess? Think of that first goal, study of pathways and connections. Well, it's not just size, it's not just how many cells there are, it's how those cells are connected. one of the things that's increased very noticeably in the human forebrain compared with that of other animals, even other primates, is the interconnections within the neocortex. The amount, and that's in the white matter. Remember, Gall was the first one to distinguish white and gray matter. Well, that white matter are the axons, actually the myelinated axons. Most of them are myelinated if they travel long distances. And we'll be learning about that pretty soon. Those are the interconnections. And then where do they connect? One cell to another? At what structure? The synapse, okay? Actually, an axon will make many synapses with a cell and with many different cells. So one cell may connect with thousands of other cells. Okay, so but still size does make a difference, and they assume that their fatal assumption was really this last one. The shape of the skull corresponds to the shape of the underlying brain. And they thought you could read character simply by palpating and studying the shape of the head. Right. And they used an anecdotal method. I just want to point out that it was important because of the attention it drew to brain behavior relationships and the successors in neurology that did case studies and also of humans with brain damage, and also the experimental neurologists who did brain lesions in animals in order to study behavioral effects. When they localize function, their conclusions seem rather conservative compared to the phrenologists, so they were more easily accepted. And an example of the people that scientists who did human case studies is Broca in 1861. And I showed you this functional map, and I've marked it here now on the slide. This corresponds to Broca's area. In the left frontal cortex. So Broca is also one of the first to give evidence for hemispheric difference, hemispheric specialization in humans. Then we talked about localization of motor cortex, and this was a textbook picture of the position of motor cortex in the precentral gyrus. And Fritz and Hitzig in the 19th century were the first to map the motor cortex. And later others found in the postcentral gyrus, here right behind, a sensory map that was also topographic in nature. That is, different parts of the cortex represented different parts of the body. And so now I've added some pictures of the homunculus. This is a picture. What does that term mean? It means little man. The homunculus is the man in the brain. Okay, man in the head. And this is one way that that's mapped. This shows the motor cortex in a sort of a coronal section through the human brain, through the precentral gyrus, showing how different parts of the body are arranged systematically in that gyrus, with the throat structures down here. This is the area controlling chewing movements, mastication. And then the head is here, and then finally the hand and arms, and then the trunk and lower body. Now, this way of representing the map is not very accurate. Of course, they're trying to show with the color code there where different parts of the body represented. And you'll notice that the face is very big compared to the legs, and that's because there's a lot more cortex representing the movements of the face compared with the movements of the leg. Similarly, the hand is enlarged. We have more cortex representing those parts of the body that have fine movement. Okay, so, and similarly on the sensory side, where we have high sensory acuity, I brought along several of the sensory homunculus maps. This is one done for children. I didn't keep track of where the website was. I just found this. It's a recent website teaching children about the brain. Here's a picture of different representation in the postcentral gyrus, just behind the central sulcus of the human brain. And this is another way to represent the homunculus. this is actually not very accurate. The lips would be even bigger than that, and the hands would be even bigger, and the toes would be much bigger than, they would be disproportionately big. But you get the idea. Okay, it's a way, here's another one. It's a way to represent that is the amount of brain representing this different body parts. So the little man in the head is distorted. Okay. And you remember what this is? It's a pyramidal cell, which is characteristic of neocortex. Neocortex has a number of different cell types, but this is the most characteristic, numerous. I can't say it's the most numerous, but it's throughout all cortical areas. The cells are arranged in different layers. The surface of the cortex would be up here, and this would be in layer 5. There's another layer below it, and then the white matter below that. And many of the layers have these pyramidal-shaped cells. There's also a star-shaped cell that's usually smaller, a stellate cell, okay, especially in the fourth layer right up here, that doesn't have this apical dendrite, the dendrite extending from the apex of the cell all the way up to the surface. Well, these dendrites are the sort of the sensory surface of the cell. The cell, that's the surface where inputs are coming in from other cells by way of axonal contacts. And these tiny little protrusions here are called dendritic spines, a specialized structure where that receives many of the synaptic contacts. Okay, and then I talked about Carl Wernicke was particularly important because he took localization of function to another level in coming up with a connectionist model of the functional modules. So, for example, here he's showing that if you hear a word, the information from the auditory system reaches the auditory region of the neocortex, a neocortical region that's specialized for analyzing auditory input. Okay. And it goes from those areas, and there's more than one connection within the auditory areas. It goes from there to a posterior part of the temporal cortex, and we call that area Wernicke's area, after Carl Wernicke was the first to clearly show that that area is critical for the understanding of speech. Okay, so when we hear a word, it goes from auditory area to Wernicke's area, and then in order to speak the word that we heard, to repeat it, it has to go from Wernicke's area to the frontal cortex, Broca's area, and from there to the motor cortex, controlling muscles of articulation. And similarly, he shows that when we read, if we speak a written word, the information comes in to the visual cortex, and then by way of, it doesn't show that there's actually synaptic connections in the middle here, in the area, so-called visual association areas where connections are made to this. It's actually a polymodal association area that gets input not only from visual but also other sensory modalities. And that area connects to Wernicke's area, and the rest of the circuit is the same as above. And that the evidence for that model is considerable, and people that suffer damage anywhere along these pathways have these functions disturbed. And the disturbances can be very specific. So if you cut off just the disconnect the visual cortex from the speech areas, the person won't be able to read, but he might still be able to hear words and speak them and repeat them. Okay, then we pointed out how what happened in the clinic where these areas were multiplied, and often the psychological terms were used to describe functions that were found to be disturbed in case studies of the human brain. What they really did is simply summarize the literature. You know, it means that if you find psychological function written on that brain, it means somebody was found to have damage there, and that function was disturbed. The problem, there were many problems with it, because often the localization was not very good. The anatomical studies were pretty limited. They often missed extra damage that was done, so they might not have been looking at the most critical area. And that was the reason why when textbooks in physiological psychology began to be produced by scientists who were not medical people, but people like me that study brain and behavior but are not medical doctors, they began producing textbooks and they realized that they should step back a little bit because many of these localization studies were not consistent in the literature. There were many contradictions. So. But there was another objection to the localization goal that was being pursued now by many clinical neurologists. And that objection occurred much earlier in the history of the field. This idea that, hey, you can't carve up the human soul like that. Aren't we unitary beings? In other words, it was kind of philosophical or even religious belief. And I just put a little argument here for you. If we assume that the soul is the mind, and the psychologist says the mind is what organizes behavior. The neuroscientist says, well, behavior is organized by the brain. Therefore, soul is the brain, if you follow that logic. But I just point out here that many don't assume that the soul and the mind are identical. That explaining consciousness is not such an easy matter. Okay. But that general objection led to another approach to localizing function, and I call this general localization. So it's often called in historical records anti-localization because they were against these fine mosaic maps. And I talked about Fleuron, Goltz, and Lashley. We were just quickly going through Lashley at the end of the last talk. Fleuron divided the brain, all right, into different regions, but only four. The hindbrain for vital functions, cerebellum for motor coordination, optic lobes for vision, and the cerebral hemispheres for higher function. And he claimed that you couldn't really subdivide these regions, that if you damage them, you would damage those functions, but the only thing that made a difference within any of those areas was the size of the lesion, not the exact location. Well, his anatomy wasn't very good. He could see the gross subdivisions all right, but in fact, it is possible to localize more than he did. Why then would he come to such a conclusion? Well, because the analysis of behavior was very limited too. You know, if all you're looking at is whether the animal is collapsing and dying after your lesions, you won't see that maybe in some cases that's because he can't breathe properly. In other cases, it's because his heart, his blood pressure doesn't have good control, and so on and so forth. Goltz did very similar things with dogs, and the criticism is exactly the same. He was not a good behaviorist, so he described behavior in very general terms. He could see that if a dog had damage in the posterior part of the hemisphere, his vision was abnormal. And he could see if he damaged made large areas of lesion in the frontal area that the animal didn't seem to initiate behavior. Some higher function was disturbed, so he called it volition and will. And he said that basically it was the size of the lesion and not the location that made the biggest difference. Soon people began to realize that vision was located in a specific area, and those findings began to question the generality of this anti-localization idea. Lashley, in fact, contributed to some of the anatomical studies of the brain, but before he did that, in the 1920s especially, he did a large study of the rat, and he published it in a book on the nature of intelligence, and he said that he was trying to locate the engram. At least he didn't make the mistake of the localizationist saying, I'm going to locate memory in the brain. To him, the engram was the physical change that is correlated with what happens when we remember something, when we can remember something, when we learn something and have it in our memory. So he was working with a rat brain very similar to the hamster brain here, and I just want you to take a look at these. You should begin to recognize what these brains look like. These are olfactory bulbs here. You're looking down on the top of a brain. Okay, so the animal is facing to the top of the screen, and his tail is down there below the floor someplace. His skull top was removed. This is an animal that's dead, and the body and brain have been fixed, and we've exposed the brain. So you can see then the several hemispheres here of the end brain. You can see part of the midbrain, even though the midbrain is partially covered. And you can see the cerebellum back here, which is part of the hindbrain. And the rest of the hindbrain that's not covered by the cerebellum, you can see back here. And then the spinal cord would begin right here. And I've not shown that here. This is the same thing in a newborn animal, just to show the tremendous growth in the brain that occurs after birth in these animals. It also happens in humans, but humans are born in a more mature state than these small rodents. Especially you can see here in the cerebellum. This is cerebellum, the little ring of tissue here. Here it's become all of this, because most of cerebellar development is postnatal in these animals. Well, Lashley worked out a nice systematic way of representing lesions, and he reconstructed the lesions using histology, so he didn't have to depend just on his surgical notes. And sometimes he found little extra areas of damage that he had not intended, but because he disturbed a blood vessel or whatever, he did the extra damage. But he was trying to make symmetric lesions. You can see they weren't perfectly symmetric when he reconstructed them, but in most cases they were fairly symmetric, and they varied a lot in size. He did that purposely. He varied the location. This is just one example, but he put these kinds of lesions in various places in the neocortex, and then he varied the size. This is one of the small lesions he made. Here's a large one. This particular one damaged mostly auditory cortex. Other lesions would be back here in the visual cortex, other times in the somatosensory cortex in here, or in the prefrontal cortex. Some damaged more than these single regions. Okay, and they were very large. Okay, now his method was to train the rat first, before he did the surgery, on one of these three mazes, and the mazes differed in difficulty. You can judge the difficulty of the maze simply by how many trials it takes the rat to run through the maze without an error. You can see that maze one was simply a T maze. All the animal has to do is learn to turn left to reach the food. Sometimes some animals had to go left, some go right. In maze one, in maze two, he comes out of the start box here, and he basically has to learn to avoid the blind alleys to reach the goal. And the most difficult one, the one that took the most trials for the normal rats to learn, the animal had to come out of the start box, turn right, and then turn left, turn right, turn left, and turn right into the food or goal box, in order to perform without errors. If he went into made any of the wrong choices, an error was scored. and he was measuring number of errors the animal made before he reached a high level of performance. Okay, so he trained them, so every rat before was trained first until he could perform the maze, and rats are quite good at that. Then he made a surgical lesion, the bilateral lesions we've already talked about. Then he waited a little while, just so the rat was walking around again and seemed recovered from the immediate effects of the anesthesia, immediate effects of the lesion. And that's a big problem, just how long do you wait, along what are the various types of recovery that are going on after a brain lesion. And at the time he did that, he didn't know much, and still there are many of these things are not well known. And then finally, he tested the animal for retention. The idea was, if you train them and then take a piece of brain out, did you take the memory out? Okay. Very simple logic. But that was the logic of the experiments, and he put the results for all of his animal on graphs. This is actually a three-dimensional graph. The main thing here is the most difficult maze, maze 3, where you can see that the number of errors in the training of the rat after the lesion varied a lot depending on how much destruction in the brain there was. He claimed that it was only the size of the lesion that made a difference. If he made a lesion posteriorly, the animal had trouble, depending on the size of that posterior lesion. And if he made an anterior lesion, the animal also had trouble, and again, it just depended on the size. And the idea that different areas of cortex played basically the same role in learning mazes, he called principle equipotentiality. One area had the same potential for supporting maze learning as another. So he said the cortex was acting in mass, his principle of mass action. Only the quantity made a difference. Now, there were people that didn't agree with that. There was a man named Hunter that actually debated Lashley about that. He said that the rat, in order to learn mazes, he uses multiple cues. He's not dependent just on vision or just on audition or just on somatic sensation. Okay, just his sense of direction. He uses all of these things. So naturally, no matter where are you disturbing the cortex, if you're disturbing these different sensory abilities and different higher functions, you're going to disturb maze learning. But Lashley was a pretty convincing debater. And it was only much later, here at MIT, in fact, that these three investigators, Charlie Gross, Steve Chorver, and a student named Cohen, who tested the rats and helped the investigators do this experiment, they did a reanalysis of the Lashley findings based on anatomical studies and brain behavior work that showed that visual discrimination abilities depended on the visual cortex back here. I've scribbled over it here. Whereas the ability to simply alternate left and right turns is critically dependent on prefrontal cortex. That was discovered first in monkeys, but then it was found to be true also in the rat. The prefrontal cortex is way up here in the rat, sort of the frontal polar area. So they began to think that maybe Lashley's lesion simply encroached to varying degrees on these two separate functions, two separate areas, and disturbed these two separate functions. And they used a series of mazes not just Lashley's maze, but a number of different mazes, depended heavily on visual abilities, and if the mazes didn't require alternation, okay, then these mazes were not disturbed much by the frontal lesion. Okay, so that was a different result from Lashley. Then they found that if you specifically train the rat to alternate, you don't even have to use a maze, you can have him press a bar. You have him press the left bar, and then the right bar, and then the left bar. and he won't get his reward unless he alternates his responses. They found that that ability does not depend on the visual cortex. You can ablate the visual cortex, and the rat can still do that. But it does depend on this frontal cortex. Okay. So in other words, they were getting functional localization. And they concluded then that Lashley was wrong. His interpretation was wrong. His findings simply were due to varying amounts of disturbance of these two different functions. And that just shows the key to two major keys to solving problems of localizing function in the brain. You need good anatomical knowledge. Gross, Chorver, and Cohen had the much more anatomical knowledge. Lashley himself, after he had done the work on maze learning, also studied visual system and worked out the specific location of that posterior visual cortical area in the rat. There was a lot of other knowledge about localization of pathways in the brain. So that's important. If you're going to do lesion studies, you need to know what you're disturbing. But in addition, you have to understand something about behavior. It's very complex, and it's if you don't understand the nature of behavior of the animal, and it's difficult with animals, it's very even more difficult with humans, you may totally miss the boat. I'll give you another example of the role of behavioral analysis. It's a study I read when I was a student on localizing mating ability in the brain of the rat. The investigators tried to contrast male and female rats. They found that if they made large lesions of neocortex in the male rat, they disturbed his ability to mate with the female. Okay? If they made these same kinds of large lesions in the female, it didn't, they said, didn't disturb her mating ability at all. So their conclusion was is that sexual behavior depends on neocortex in males and not females. Pretty big conclusion. But let's look at it a little bit. What were they actually measuring? What were they calling mating behavior? It was very simple. They put the male and female rat together and observed whether the male mounted the female and copulated. That was it. Okay? That's mating behavior. Female behavior, if she showed the lordosis reflex, she goes into this rigid posture to receive the male, that's it. Okay? Well, it's true. You can take out the neocortex and you'll still be able to get the lordosis posture in females. But wait a minute. What's the equivalent thing in the male? Is copulation, it's not the same. The fact is, without the neocortex, the male rat does show sexual reflexes. Okay? But he's not very good at finding the female and getting position right, okay, without his neocortex. And wait a minute, what about the female? Is that all there is to mating, is going into this rigid posture? Not at all. I did a study some years ago on the role of olfaction in mating, and we got put on the cover of Science a picture of a female who's come up to a male and she's sniffing his ear. It's part of her come-on behavior that precedes mating. In fact, rodents often show, the female rodents show mate selection. Their behavior is complex. The investigators, though, who, by the way, were all male, did this study, omitted all these details about behavior. So they came to a conclusion that was very misleading. And yet it was put in textbooks and everything. I read it first in a textbook. Okay. But I learned here at MIT from Lucas Teuber, the founder of the department, and others, including Gross, Charlie Gross, who was on the faculty then, and Steve Chorver, that you don't just read the literature and accept it. You question it. And I hope even things I tell you, you don't just accept all the time. I'm doing my best to convey what we know, but and get you introduced to the field, but I also want to get you to think about it. And that's why I'm giving you these examples. People are often wrong. And when it comes to localizing function, these two factors are always important. Concerning memory, what about this thing that could memory be not located specifically, but think about the nature of the problem, especially if you think of the SR model and the complex connections between stimulus and response involved. A memory that leads to a change in the connections could happen anywhere along the pathway, and there could be many synapses involved. But then what is all that neocortex for? I once went through a telephone switching station some years ago, a toll station run by Bell Telephone Company at that time. And I wanted to understand how it worked. I knew nothing about this, but I did know something about brain anatomy. My brother was in charge of that toll station, and he explained to me that at a certain point where these huge numbers of cables were, that's where all the inputs were coming in from the phone systems in the whole region. Okay, and they went into huge numbers of relays. Okay, and we could walk up and down the aisles of these things. There were so many of them. And he explained to me how the switching occurred and how the routing was done through these switches. It was all input and output, all sensory and motor. So finally I asked him, well, how do you remember who made what call so you can charge the money? Oh, he said, oh, that's in that little blue box over there. It was a thing about this big. Obviously a different technology, but they, in other words, the memory was not, didn't require all the space that the input and output did. Now, it's a very crude analogy, but telephone systems have sometimes been used to talk about the brain as a communication system. I just want to point out that when you damage the brain, when you disturb a higher function, like maze learning, that maze learning depends a lot on various input and output structures, not just on these integrating factors. And where the memory is an issue that can be a complex one, and without understanding all the circuits involved in the behavior, we can't really begin to ask that question. What is localized in the brain? Can we localize a conscious ability? Can we localize memory? Don McKay has said that these are not brain words at all. So if we read about, and you will in your textbook, you'll read about centers for pleasure, centers for sex, hunger, centers for doing mental arithmetic, and so forth. But these are psychological terms. What is localized is not those things, but simply physical processes and a structural substrate. We're never going to find the ghost in the machine. What you call you is the ghost, right? You won't find it in there. What you'll find is action potentials, electrical changes in this gelatinous mass that consists of huge numbers of cells. And that's all you're ever going to find when you go in there. The Russian neuropsychologist Alexander Luria put it this way, that mental functions as complex functional systems cannot be localized in narrow zones of cortex or in isolated cell groups because it involves a complicated system. It's not throwing out physiological determinism at all. It's just pointing out something about its complexity. McKay went a little further and dealt with this question. Can't we, at a general level, just say that thinking's localized in the brain? Do brains think? He said this is a poor question because it mixes different conceptual levels. If we want to use language consistently, we can't say that brains think or decide. Brains do those physical things appropriate in their own logical dimensions. Those things I was just talking about. as correlates of what people do, the whole system, when deciding, thinking, feeling, hoping, fearing, believing, and so forth. A very interesting little paper he wrote called A Mind's Eye View of the Brain. There's one other goal that's been common in among people explaining behavior in neurological terms, and that is simply to find the correlations. When we do a specific thing, what is happening at that moment in the brain? And it's really a never-ending fascination with people. It's really a testing the assumption we all make. We assume that something is happening in the brain, no matter what we do, but just finding the correlations are very interesting to people, and they've also played a major role in the field. An example is recording with the electrical potentials generated in the scalp by underlying brain activity. It's called the electroencephalograph, and the patterns of brain waves, they're often called, these little electrical changes in the scalp, the patterns of activity that you can record that way from a sensitive recorder are correlated with states of arousal or different stages of sleep. They're really not just local functions at all. So there's a very, and that, it gave us a whole different view of how function is localized, because we found that the brain changes its state. And when, in general, when the state changes, it changes all over. I mean, it might be a little bit different in different parts of the brain, different regions, but the changes are widespread. So the brain has different states controlled by activities that are not localized to these specific areas and that the anatomists point out or that the brain localizers pointed out. But in fact, we can also find very specific localization of activity that's correlated with function. So, example, the motor cortex. We can find an area representing the hand and wrist. Okay, we can find neurons there that always fire when I move my hand upward. We can find other neurons that always fire when I move my hand downward. We can find neurons that fire at different stages of that movement. There are some that precede the movement. Others that occur during and just after the movement. Okay, the precise correlations of that nature. So these are examples from neurophysiology of brain and behavioral correlations. Such correlations, of course, are limited. You can't, just by finding the correlation, conclude anything about causation without knowing something about the anatomy and about the involvement of other areas in the same behavior. But they're still interesting. We have to know such things if we're going to explain how the brain is controlling behavior. Modern imaging techniques are basically that of that nature. They're finding correlations of metabolic changes in specific areas of the brain during specific kinds of behavior or even specific kinds of mental states. I just want to point out a little bit about these techniques because you're going to see pictures not just in this class but more in other classes, including in some of the colloquium talks we have. And when you see a picture of a functional image, often they will talk about some function and they will show a specific area and they'll say, see, that is the area that was activated. That's the term they use. Well, what do they mean by that, activated? Let's just analyze it a little bit, because I want you to be able to think about this as good MIT analytic thinkers. Don't just accept that that area is, just that area is activated when we do something. Like when I speak the word, you know, yes, the Broca's area is going to show more metabolic activity. Okay? That's true. But we've used averaging techniques. First of all, it's simply glucose utilization or oxygenation. Okay? We're not actually measuring electrical activity with those methods. But also, we're using complex mathematical methods of averaging and filtering the information. Okay, so when I'm speaking a word, there's a lot of the brain is active, and the brain stem is active too. Okay. What we've done is we've filtered it so we get only, we have a cutoff, and we're going to deal only with the most active area. We're simply going to forget about the rest. Now, if we used it, and it's based on an average, if we did it differently, if we only took a part of the brain and then applied that same mathematics, say, just to the temporal lobe regions, we might get a somewhat different result. Okay. But nobody bothers to do that. They use whole brain averaging, and then they show the areas of greatest activation. What if what was critical for function is reduced activity of an area? You're not going to see it activated. You might come to totally the wrong conclusion. Okay. So think about those things when you look at imaging. There's still a lot of engineering and mathematical problems to be solved in brain imaging. And MIT is devoting a lot of effort to that. We're building a whole new imaging center. And for a long time, MIT has played an important role in working with MGH scientists on developing imaging techniques. Okay, so we will go on from that point next time.